You know, it has been an absolutely crazy week, and I wanted to take a moment and tell you a little bit about what's been going on, because it has had a real effect on me, and an effect on Marion too as well. And it's also affecting what I wanted to talk to you about this morning. So a lot of significant stuff. I think that perhaps because the effect is tied into the recovery community, we have a lot more things going on of a crisis nature in people's lives and in families. Maybe that's not so, but it just seems like this week so many things hit all at once, and it was really pretty striking. Yesterday, Marion and I and Jeff and Lisa had the opportunity to go visit a friend of ours in the hospital, Chester Wondries. I don't know how many of you may know him, but he's a dear friend of us. It seems like wherever we would pop up, he was there, you know. If it was at Vineyard, if it was at Calvary Capo Beach, wherever it happened to be. And just a wonderful man. And he now has cancer. And it has metastasized, and it's throughout his body, and he has not given very long to live. And so we were able to go there, and Lisa brought her guitar, and we sang a little bit, and we talked a little bit. And I don't know if any of you have had, or how many of you have had the opportunity to be with someone at near their last moments in life. And as I've said here before, there's nothing that focuses your mind like a deadline. And there is no other deadline like this one for Chester. And so I was listening really carefully to what he might have to say. And I wasn't disappointed. Chester had an experience either the day before or just in the last few days where he said that he felt completely the peace of God. He felt the presence of God, the peace of God, and whatever fear he had and whatever tension he had was released at that point. And you could just see it in him. You could just see that he was completely at peace. He was joking with us. He was just talking to us. But he said that all the preaching that he ever heard and all of the studying and the doctrine just meant nothing to him anymore in the face of the sense of that peace. Now, you know, a teaching pastor doesn't exactly like to hear that. But I'll tell you what, he was exactly right. And it was humbling, and it was beautiful, and it was riveting all at the same time. To see the realization, the recognition in Chester's eyes that he had experienced the reality of God's presence, maybe in a deeper and more profound way than he had to this point in his life. But that he realized that all of this stuff that we do, all this religious stuff, all this teaching, all this headwork, this intellectualizing, is just nothing in the face of that. You know, I've often said in here that what we do here, the teaching that we do, the information that I try to convey to you, is just like boosters on a rocket. I mean, once you're in orbit, you jettison those things. It's like training wheels on a bike. Once you can balance, you take them off because they're just limiting you anymore. Theology is like that. Doctrine is like that. It's designed to get you to a place where you can experience the way Chester did, the reality of God's presence, so that you know that you know that you know that he is as real as your next breath. And he is there for you, and he cares for you, and he loves you in that way. At that point, you know, what more can any teacher do? Well, we can help maybe clear out some of the other obstacles that you might have in your way. But that's really it. And I was so struck by that. And I was so glad to have been able to share that moment with Chester. And I'm going to be flying to Salt Lake City on Wednesday. Because a family that... The husband of this family came through our program, just left to go back to Utah about a month and a half ago or so. And they have an adopted son who is 18, who is also an addict and committed suicide last week. And the service is actually tomorrow, and I'm going to go on Wednesday because they said there was so much craziness, but they want to be able to sit down and talk. I can't even imagine what they're going through to have an 18-year-old commit suicide. And it was funny, the first time that they called and I talked to them, Mark was the one who was falling apart, and his wife, Lorendi, was doing pretty well. And then when I talked to him yesterday, it was just the reverse. Mark was sounding pretty strong, and Lorendi was falling apart. And that's just the way it goes, isn't it? You know, it's going through some crisis in our lives. We're up and we're down, and, you know, they aren't necessarily in sync, but hopefully one person will stay not crazy at a time. But they're moving through it. And they gave me permission to use their names and to tell you about that because they would love to have your prayers as well as they go through this. But one of the things that they're doing is they're going to create a foundation in Sean's name, that's their son, and they're going to want to try to help other kids not to go where Sean went, and other families not to have to experience what they're experiencing right now, and to try to bring some meaning and purpose out of Sean's death. And that just struck me again. Because you know what? We can survive, overcome, and prevail over anything, any pain and suffering, any tragedy, as long as it has some meaning and some purpose to us. Without that, it's just tragedy. But if they can bring some meaning and purpose, and they can do something good for others through this, because maybe it has galvanized them in a way that they weren't before, it gives them some credibility maybe in the eyes of others that they didn't have before, who knows how this all works. But the fact that they're doing this is really significant and very important. You know, in the midst of this tragedy. We have another family whose child is in jail right now because of a car accident that was happening under the influence. And Jeff got to go visit her a couple of days ago. And the significance of what he was able to bring to her, but also to see the strength in her, even in the midst of her suffering. Jeff was saying that he saw strength in her. He saw perseverance in her, when he didn't see that before. Necessarily. So hopefully she is seeing some meaning and purpose in her experience, and that her parents who are going through, I mean, imagine the frustration of not being able to help your child in a difficult situation, especially when you can see how difficult it is. When you see them through the glass and you see the dark circles under the eyes and the sallow complexion and losing weight, and you know what they're going through. It's written all over their face, and you're helpless to do something. And you are helpless to try to change the course of your child's life that took them to this pass. You know, the frustration of being helpless and not being able to affect the outcome of one of your loved one's life is huge. It just weighs on you. Another friend of mine has a fiance, and he is now sober. He's in the program. He's doing really, really well. And yet she is still using, and he is frustrated because there's nothing that he can do to get her to see the way he has changed in life and to appreciate that. And now she's pushing him away because she's not ready to go where he's going. And he can see the difference. He can see the unhealth in her. Whereas before, hey, they were peas in a pod. It was fine. But now he has moved to a place that is nearer the light, and he can see that she's not there. And yet it's heartbreaking to him because he loves her. And he wants to help her, and he wants to be close, but he knows it's not possible right now. That frustration again of not being able to do what you want to do for somebody, to change the outcome of their lives. And then me personally, Marion and I personally have someone very close to us who actually has a dissociative disorder. Now, I, as a counselor, I can work with someone as long as there's a shared reality. You know? We can put a bowl on the table in front of us, between us, and we can agree, okay, it's blue, it's round, it's this, it's that. But if you don't have a shared reality, then how do you even communicate? There are no words, you know? And she does not see reality the same way we do. And again, the complete sense of helplessness and frustration. There's nothing I can say. There's nothing I can do. You know, she can go the way that she's going to go, and I can't affect it. And it's just been heartbreaking again to both Marion and me. What a week, huh? An incredible amount of pain and suffering, of frustration. But as I started to think about it, you know, Marion and I kind of looked at each other, and Marion said, "What do you think the Lord is trying to tell us?" That's you all. Have you ever done that? You know, when you go through something crazy or a whole series, what is the Lord trying to tell me? What are you really asking at that point? What is the meaning and what is the purpose, right? What is the Lord trying to tell me? Because without something of significance, some sort of meaning here, it really is just random and hard to deal with. And as I started thinking about Marion's question, when I really started thinking about, maybe it's not so much what the Lord is trying to tell me, but what are we willing to hear? I think is really the more operative question. The Lord is always telling us something. The Lord is always communicating His love, His connection with us, It's always there. It's always on. It never turns off. What are we willing to hear? What significance are we willing to glean, to take out of the difficult circumstances in which we find ourselves? You know, what was James talking about when he said, count it all joy when you encounter trials and tribulations? Because these are the very things that complete you, that perfect you, that mature you. But sometimes it's difficult to see it that way. But it's up to us. It's our choice. We can glean meaning and purpose out of difficult circumstances or not. Because the meaning and purpose is always there. Because God's presence is always there. A famous psychologist named Viktor Frankl, a Jewish psychologist of the last century who came through Auschwitz and found a sense of meaning and purpose even in that circumstance. Continuing his practice in Vienna after the war, he had an elderly man come in to his office and say that he just didn't know how to continue living because his wife had just died. You know, his wife of 50, 60 years. And it was just devastating to him, and he couldn't go through another day. And Viktor Frankl said to him, what would it have been like if you had died first? How would your wife be reacting right now? And he said, oh, she would have just been unable to even take another breath. And he said, well, then your pain and your suffering is saving her from having to go through the same thing. And he just straightened up and said, thank you, doctor, and walked out, and he lost a good client, I suppose. But you know what? Just being able to see the meaning and the purpose in that tragedy allowed him to persevere. His suffering had meaning and purpose because he was saving his wife from the same thing. And he loved her so much that God gave him the will and the serenity and the peace to carry on. What are we willing to hear about the things that are going on in our lives? A few weeks ago we talked about the fact that all we really give each other is information. Another psychological school of thought. Remember that one? Of all the things that we exchange, what we really give to another person is limited to information. We can tell them things. We can intellectualize things. Does that even sound right to you? Does that sound like it's true? Because I had to think about it for a while. I mean, we can give material objects to people. We can give them love, however you want to define that. We can give them violence, and we can give them pain. We can give them all sorts of things. Is that really just information? But think about it. Two siblings growing up in the same household together, treated the same environment, the same parenting style, and they go in vastly different directions. How does that happen? It's because what we take out of, what we interpret out of what is given to us is very, very personal. It's unique to us. Again, it's not what someone is saying, it's more what are we willing to hear. And so, whatever we're given is ours to try to figure out what the meaning and purpose is in a given situation. And this is really, really important to understand. Even love, when we give love to somebody, it's just information until they respond to it in kind. Now, just this week, I had to call the psychiatrist of my friend to alert him to a suicide threat that she made. And he called the police to go and check on her to make sure that she was okay. Now, to me, it was the thing that I was compelled to do out of love. If she tells me that she is thinking of suicide, then I need to act. I can't just let that lie. And yet she interpreted it as an act of betrayal. And I got every word in the book, and I got my head handed to me, because I betrayed that trust. My act of love was her act of betrayal. Even the love that we give is still subject to interpretation. This is something that is so important for us to understand. Does Jesus talk about this? You bet he does. And he does it right here where we're at in Matthew 7 as we continue through the Sermon on the Mount. If you have your sheets, take a look. Because ultimately, everything that we receive in life is subject to the judgment that we make. The judgment that we make about that thing. Remember we said last week, the reality that we believe is the reality that we endure. I'm going to say that again. The reality we believe is the reality we endure. Why? Because what we believe colors everything that we receive, colors everything that we perceive. It is going through that filter. And so what we believe is of critical importance. And so when Jesus says, do not judge so that you will not be judged, for in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured unto you. That doesn't mean that God is doing it to you because we are judging someone else. God will now judge us either now or later at the end of our lives and grant us admission into heaven or not by some sort of measure, some sort of ledger that he's keeping up in the clouds there. What it means is that before we ever impose our will or our standards on somebody else, we're already living under them ourselves. What we believe about reality, we are enduring already before we ever make the move to impose it on somebody else. And then Jesus takes the step further. And he says at 7:3, why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. The first thing we should probably do is just take a look at those two words, the speck and the log. You know, the speck, gela in Aramaic, or karphos in Greek, can mean a splinter, it can mean a chip of wood, it can mean some little mote. It also meant like the spiculae, the little, they call them beards on the head of grain and wheat or barley that blows around in the wind and gives you sinus problems and all this stuff. In a rural setting that Jesus was communicating this, it was any little thing that was constantly irritating your eyes. And so once again, he's using imagery that everybody understands. You know, the speck that is in your eye, the one that makes your eye water, that someone's trying to help you to see, to get out of there. And then the log actually would be better translated as any squared piece of timber. A crossbeam, a plank, anything like that. But a piece of timber that would be used for building. And so the contrast couldn't be clearer, right, that Jesus is using. And who can say that Jesus doesn't have a sense of humor? All right? Let's picture this. This guy staggering around with this big plank in his eye trying to see. You know, Jesus uses these wonderful, colorful phrases, memorable phrases that everybody would understand. Just two chapters earlier in Matthew 5, Jesus is talking about, if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. In Luke, he says, if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. If your eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out. Because it's better to go maimed into the kingdom than to go whole into the fiery pit. I mean, can't you just picture all these maimed and, you know, hobbling people going into the kingdom? I mean, Jesus is not serious about this in terms of physical way to actually do this, but he's using this example. When he says, if someone sues you to take your cloak, give them your tunic as well. Well, see, that doesn't mean a whole lot to us. But in first century Judea, that meant you were naked. You're standing there naked because all they had was a one-piece tunic and a mantle that went over that. And so you're naked. He talks about if someone goes to slap you on your right cheek, offer the left one, the other one as well. Well, in Judea, everyone used their right hand to deliver a blow. So if you're going to deliver a blow to someone on their right cheek, how's it going to be? It's going to be a backhand. That backhand blow is the blow from a superior to a subordinate. Well, if you offer your left cheek, how are you going to have to slap? You're going to have to slap forehand. Now, in a patriarchal Hebrew culture, that's sort of a sissy slap. You don't slap that way. See, we don't understand some of the humorous phrases that Jesus is using here, but it wouldn't have been lost on his first hearers. You know, Jesus is wonderful this way. If you read between the lines and you see what's going on, you see a man who is fully engaged and in love with life, not stoic and stern, but just smiling and using these phrases so people get it and they're laughing at the same time. So Jesus is using these phrases to try to get these things across. And this one right here that he uses about the log and the speck is not even original with Jesus. He was quoting a familiar proverb. It would be like us saying that people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. It's the same idea. The proverb that Jesus uses here is one that was in current usage. There's an Arabic proverb of the same thing that goes, how can you see the splinter in your brother's eye and not see the crossbeam in your own eye? So Jesus wasn't even using an original phrase here. He's using something that everybody already understood. It was like a shorthand to get where he wanted to go in a humorous way. But he doesn't just leave it at that first level. He takes it to a deeper level and a deeper level still. And that's what I want to try to get you to understand this morning. That really, in context, what Jesus is saying at this first level, he's making the distinction between small offenses and great sins, of course. It's like he told the Pharisees, you know, you strain at the gnat and you swallow a camel. What did he mean by that? Well, in the dietary laws, there were clean animals and there were unclean animals. Animals you could eat and those that you couldn't. And the smallest unclean animal was a gnat, the tiny little insect that flies around. Couldn't eat that. And the largest unclean animal was a camel. Why? Well, the camel didn't have cloven hooves. It chews its cud, but it didn't have cloven hooves, so you couldn't eat a camel. And what the Pharisees would actually do to make sure that they were totally pure, they would put a piece of cloth or muslin over their cups before they poured in the liquid to make sure that they strained out any gnats that might be floating in the juice or the wine or whatever it was they were drinking. And yet Jesus says, you deal with these little details of the law, but then you let these huge things go by. Well, you're not fulfilling the law anymore. So it's basically that same idea he's trying to get across. So what we're basically saying here at this first level, Matthew 7:3 and in parentheses there, is simple unawareness. It's easier to see someone else's fault than it is to see our own, isn't it? Don't we do that over and over and over again? You know? I might be singing off key here, but I'll tell when Lisa's singing off key before me. It's just like that. It's human nature. It's so much easier to be objective about someone else than our own selves. And the classic example of that is King David. After he sleeps with Bathsheba, if you know the story, he sleeps with Bathsheba when her husband is off to war. And then as soon as he realizes that she became pregnant, he brings her husband back and tries to get him to go home and sleep with his wife to cover up the fact that it's really his child. But Uriah won't do it. He's too principled. He said, if my brothers are sleeping out in the cold, I'm not going to go in and sleep with my wife. And he sleeps at the front door of the castle. He won't, of the palace. He won't go in to his wife. And then David makes him drunk and tries to send him home drunk to see if he'll do it then. And he still won't do it. And so what does David do? He sends him back into battle, has to carry his own death sentence in his hand, a notice to the commander saying to put him in the thick of the battle at the front of the line and then withdraw so that he is killed. And he is. And then Jesus takes Bathsheba as his own wife and marries her, and then she bears him a son. And then the prophet Nathan comes to him and tells him a story and says, there is a man who had livestock and flocks galore, and then a very poor man who had one little lamb ewe that he was able to purchase, and he nurtured it and he cared for it as his own. And when a wealthy traveler, a guest, comes to the rich man, he doesn't want to kill one of his own, so he takes this man, this poor man's lamb, and slaughters it and gives it to the traveler. And David, of course, is infuriated. Who is that man? You know, he needs to be brought before the justice of the court. And Nathan says, you are that man. You know, the classic inability to see the same offense in ourselves that we can see in someone else. Scott?
I'm not sure if I misheard.
Maybe I did. Did I say that? Okay. I should have been saying David throughout. You got to watch me. You got to watch me, I'm telling you, especially on a day like today. I couldn't remember a couple of the songs that we were supposed to play either. But see, that's it. And Jesus is saying at this first level, at verse 3, it's our simple ignorance. It's the unawareness that allows us to see the problem with the other person and not in ourselves. But now let's take it a step further in verse 4. How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? Now we're moving into an area of arrogance and even hypocrisy, right? Where we are attempting or presuming to correct, to discipline, to reprove another person when we can't even correct or reprove or discipline ourselves. And do we really think that people don't see through that? There is a scene that I need to read you. It's very short. From Hamlet. Y'all need to read more Shakespeare. Shakespeare is just wonderful. If you don't know Hamlet, Hamlet is a prince of Denmark, and he's at odds with the king, because the king, his uncle, killed his father, the previous king, in order to succeed him in the throne. And so Hamlet is just beside himself, of course. But the king, knowing this, that he needs to get rid of Hamlet, his only threat, he employs two of Hamlet's oldest friends. They go way back to school together, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. But Hamlet knows exactly what's going on. He knows he's being betrayed, and he knows his two old friends are trying to play him and plotting to kill him. And in one scene with one of them, Guildenstern, some players come in playing recorders, you know, the little musical instruments. And Hamlet says, "Oh, the recorders, let me see one." And he takes one in his hand, and he turns to Guildenstern and says, "Will you play upon this pipe?" "My lord, I cannot. I pray you. Believe me, I cannot. I do beseech you. I know not the touch of it, my lord." And Hamlet says, "'Tis as easy as lying." "Govern these vintages with your fingers and thumb. Give it breath with your mouth, and it will discourse most eloquent music. Look you, these are the stops. But these I cannot command, my lord, or any utterance of harmony. I have not the skill." And Hamlet replies, "Why, look you now, how unworthy a thing you make of me. You would play upon me. You would seem to have my stops. You would pluck out the heart of my mystery. You would sound me from my lowest note to the top of my compass. And there is much music, excellent voice in this little organ, yet cannot you make it speak? Do you think I am easier to be played on than a pipe? Call me what instrument you will, though you can fret me, you cannot play upon me." I love that scene because it so illustrates what we're talking about here. Do we really think that people don't see through us? When we have not governed ourselves and we attempt to govern others, when we presume to put upon others those things that we have not mastered ourselves. And Jesus says, "You hypocrite." Now, we may not actually be a hypocrite. We may believe the things that we're trying to put on the other person, but what does it matter if we haven't done it ourselves? We don't have the authority. And this is when Jesus is described in scriptures as having taught with authority. Remember that? He taught with authority because it was obvious from his life that he had mastered the principles himself. He taught not like the scribes and the Pharisees, who were reciting what they had been told, who were reciting chapter and verse of the law. Jesus taught with authority. Jesus had mastered this. And this is what he's talking about here. And then in the third step, in 7:5, he says, "You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." And this third step that Jesus is taking us to is a step of realization. You know, the step of realizing that the only choice we have to make is the choice over our own behavior. That frustration we feel when we can't affect the outcome of another person, when we can't change the course of our children's lives, when we can't help a loved one, when there are no words that we can say to another to draw them in, to try to give them a bit of what we have learned, of the realization that we have come through, we realize ours is the only choice that we can make. We can't make a choice for another. And so Jesus is saying, take the log out of your eye. Take the plank out of your eye. You know, if you want to think about it, the whole entire sum of the spiritual journey is taking the logs out of our eyes so that we can see clearly the reality around us. So we can see who we are, who we really are, in relation to who God is. So we can see our meaning and purpose in every moment clearly. Not colored by the programming of the past, not a knee-jerk reaction to every stimulus that comes our way, but we can actually see what is happening in the moment, and we can choose that which is best for everyone around us, even including ourselves. But until we do that, we cannot do anything for anybody else. In a very real sense, we need to become the person that we want the other one to be. Think about a married couple, you know? Marriage counseling, okay. One spouse is coming. You know, if only my husband, if only my wife would do this. If only they would do that. If only they would be this way. You know, if only they would pick this up, or if only you know what? If each married person would become the spouse they want their spouse to be, it would be so much easier for that spouse to be the spouse they want them to be. Think about single people. You know, they're looking for the perfect mate out there. Do you know, someone told me this and it never leaves my head, you will never attract someone healthier than you are. You will never attract someone healthier than you are. In other words, you need to become the person that you want to marry in order to attract the person you want to marry. This is what Jesus is telling us. Take the log out of your own eye. The only choice that you can make, the only realization that you can make is for yourself. But once you have done that, the ancient desert fathers had this wonderful vision that their whole society back in the 3rd and 4th century, you know, when Christianity had become married with Roman power and was really, in their mind, falling apart as it became more institutionalized, they saw their whole society as a shipwreck from which they had to swim for their lives. But they realized that as long as they're flopping around in all of the debris and the jetsam in the water, they were no good to anybody else. They needed to get their feet planted on dry land, and then they could reach in and help somebody else. It's the same idea here. We need to realize that we need to go there first in order to have any authority to do anything for anybody else. And we also have the serenity to know that there's only so much we can do for somebody else. But the best that we can ever do is to model it. Francis of Assisi said, "Preach the gospel continuously, use words where necessary." If we would do that, if we would just live the gospel, it would be so much easier. Finally, changing others won't change our reality. We're trying to do that from the outside in, and that never works. If we think that our happiness, our contentment, our meaning and purpose is based on somebody else or something else, a circumstance or a situation changing in our favor, then we will be always chasing that dream for the rest of our lives. But once we realize that if we change ourselves, if we truly transform from the inside out, as Jesus is asking us to do, then everything changes. Our whole perception of every circumstance and every person, whether it's agreeable or not, whether it's truly tragic or not, will change because it'll be imbued with the meaning and purpose that God's Spirit and presence gives everything, every moment, if we'll just see it. Let's pray. Father, I never want to minimize or trivialize the pain that somebody may be going through. And sometimes when we talk about these things, it sounds like a greeting card. It sounds like some sort of platitude. Help us to realize that whatever we're going through, the way through, the cure is always the same. It's always leaning into the sense of your Spirit and presence in this moment. And as difficult as it may seem to do, when true tragedies strike, and we are just taken down within an inch of our lives, that if we can, if we will, reach out to you, lean into you in this moment, we will find the peace that we crave, and we will find the meaning and the purpose that help us to go forward. So whatever any one of us is going through, Lord, no matter how great or how small, help us to find you in it. Help us to find your peace and your contentment and your meaning and your purpose. And we thank you, Father, with everything in us for all that you're doing. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Hey, we did it by 11:30. Let's all stand and let's say the Lord's Prayer. Our little tradition.
His Father, our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.
Amen. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.